This is Audible.
Author's note. The literary antecedents of this novel lie in two earlier works of mine. The unsolved murders in Jefferson Davis Parish form the backdrop for the Dave Robichaux novel titled The Glass Rainbow, published by Simon & Schuster in 2010. These homicides are often referred to in the media as the Jeff Davis Eight. The bombing of the Indian village in Latin America happened in 1956. I wrote about this incident in the short story titled The Wild Side of Life, published in the winter issue of the Southern Review in 2017.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Robichaux, a novel by James Lee Burke, read by Will Patton.
Chapter 1. Like an early 19th century poet, when I have melancholy moments and feel the world is too much for us and that late and soon we lay waste to our powers in getting and spending, I'm forced to pause and reflect upon my experiences with the dead and the hold they exert on our lives. This may seem a macabre perspective on one's life, but at a certain point it seems to be the only one we have. Mortality is not kind, and do not let anyone tell you it is. If there is such a thing as wisdom, and I have serious doubts about its presence in my own life, it lies in the acceptance of the human condition, and perhaps the knowledge that those who have passed on are still with us, out there in the mist, showing us the way, sometimes uttering a word of caution from the shadows, sometimes visiting us in our sleep, as bright as a candle burning inside a basement that has no windows. On a winter morning, among white clouds of fog out at Spanish Lake, I would see the boys in Butternut splashing their way through the flooded cypress, their muskets held above their heads, their equipment tied with rags so it wouldn't rattle. I was standing no more than 10 feet from them, although they took no notice of me, as though they knew I had not been born yet, and their travail and sacrifice were not mine to bear. Their faces were lean from privation, as pale as wax, their hair uncut, the rents in their uniforms stitched clumsily with string. Their mouths were pinched, their eyes luminous with caution. The youngest soldier, a drummer boy, could not have been older than 12. On one occasion, I stepped into the water to join them. Even then, none acknowledged my presence. The drummer boy stumbled and couldn't right himself, struggling with the leather strap around his neck and the weight of his drum. I reached out to help him and felt my hand and arm sink through his shoulder. A shaft of sunlight pierced the canopy, turning the fog into white silk. In less than a second, the column was gone. Long ago, I ceased trying to explain events such as these to either myself or others. Like many my age, I believe people in groups are to be feared, and that arguing with others is folly, and the knowledge of one generation cannot be passed down to the next. Those may seem cynical sentiments, but there are certain truths you keep inside you and do not defend, lest you cheapen and then lose them altogether. Those truths have less to do with the dead than the awareness that we are no different from them, that they are still with us, and we are still with them, and there is no afterlife, but only one life, a continuum in which all time occurs at once, like a dream inside the mind of God. Why should an old man, thrice widowed, dwell on things that are not demonstrable and have nothing to do with a reasonable view of the world? Because only yesterday, on a broken sidewalk in a shabby neighborhood at the bottom of St. Claude Avenue in the lower Ninth Ward of St. Bernard Parish, under a colonnade that was still twisted out of shape by Katrina, across from a liquor store with barred windows that stood under a live oak probably 200 years old. I saw a platoon of Confederate infantry march out of a field to the tune of Darling Nellie Gray and disappear through the wall of a gutted building and not exit on the other side. The man I came to see was Fat Tony Nemo, also known as Tony the Nose, Tony Squid, or Tony Nineball, the latter not because he was a pool shark, but because he packed a nineball into a bartender's mouth with the butt of a pool cue. Of course, that was during his earlier incarnation when he was a collector for Dodoni Jacano, and the two of them used to drive around New Orleans in Didi's caddy convertible, terrifying whoever couldn't make the weekly vig, a blood-stained baseball bat propped up in the back seat. Currently, Fat Tony was involved in politics and narcotics and porn and casinos and Hollywood movies and the concrete business. He had also laundered money for the triads in Hong Kong and helped Somoza's Greaseballs introduce crack cocaine to America's inner cities. In terms of territory, he had fingers in pies all over Louisiana, Mississippi, and Florida. If he had any sense of morality or fear about a judgment down the track, I never saw it. So why would a semi-retired sheriff's detective from Iberia Parish want to make a social call on a psychopath like Tony Squid? Simple. Most investigative cops, often without knowing who Niccolo Machiavelli was, adhere to his admonition to keep your friends close but your enemies closer. Less simple is the fact that we share much of the same culture as the lowlifes, and we are more alike than different, and the information they give us is indispensable. Fat Tony was sitting in a swivel chair behind his desk when I entered his office. No, that's not correct. Tony didn't sit. He piled himself into a chair or on a couch like a gelatinous heap of whale sperm thrown on a beach, except he was wearing a blue suit with a red boutonniere in the lapel. A sword with a scrolled brass guard and a plain metal scabbard lay across his ink pad.
"I'm glad you could come, Dave. You never disappoint. That's why I like you,"
he wheezed. "What's the haps, Tony?"
"I'm on an oxygen bottle. I'm scheduled for a colostomy. I couldn't get laid in a whorehouse that has an ATM. My wife tells me I got a serious case of GAPO. Otherwise, I'm doing great. What kind of question is that?"
He had to catch his breath before he could continue.
"Want a drink?"
"No, thanks. What's GAPO?"
"Gorilla armpit odor. You still on the wagon?"
"I'm still in AA, if that's what you mean."
"The same thing, right?"
"No."
"Whatever. Take Cleet Purcell to a meeting with you."
"What's Cleet done?"
"What hasn't he done? He's a fucking cancer on the whole city. He should have a steel codpiece locked on his body so he can't reproduce."
"How can I help you, Tony?"
"Maybe I can help you. I heard about your wife."
"I appreciate your concern. I need to get back to New Iberia."
"She got killed in an accident?"
I nodded.
"What about 3 months ago?"
2 years. She was T-boned by a guy in a pickup. I'd rather talk about something else. He handed me the sword.
"I got this at a flea market in Memphis. I asked an expert what it's worth. He said he'd take it off my hands for $3,000. The real value, what is it?"
"I wouldn't know."
"You know about history? What the names of these places on the hilt mean, whether those places make the sword more valuable? What's this Cemetery Hill stuff? Who fights a war in a fucking cemetery?"
The brass on the handle was engraved with the name of Lieutenant Robert S. Broussard, 8th Louisiana Infantry. The base of the blade was stamped with the initial CSA and the name of the maker, James Conning of Mobile, Alabama, and the year 1861.
"I did some Googling,"
Tony said.
"The guy who owned us was from New Iberia. It's worth a lot more than $2,000 or $3,000, right? Maybe that guy was famous for something."
You couldn't find any of that on the internet with all the Civil War junk that's on sale?
You can't trust the internet. It's full of crazoids.
I couldn't begin to sort through the contradictions in what he had just said. This was a typical Fat Tony conversation. Trying to get inside his mind was akin to submerging your hand in an unflushed toilet. Outside, some black kids were breaking bottles with an air rifle in a vacant lot. There were concrete foundations in the lot without structures on them. A garbage truck was driving down a street, seagulls picking at its overflow. "Is this about Crete?" I said.
"I got no problem with Purcell. Other people do. It's true he took out that fat dick of his at the Southern Yacht Club and hosed down Bobby Earl's car."
"I don't know," I lied.
"2 weeks ago he did it again, at the casino."
"Crete did?"
"No, the Pope. Earl put his lady friend in the car and suddenly she's sitting in a puddle of piss."
"Why did you show me this sword, Tony?"
"Because the family of the guy who owned it lives in New Iberia. I thought maybe they'd want it."
"What does any of this have to do with Crete and Bobby Earl?"
"Nothing."
My head was throbbing. "It was good seeing you."
"Sit down. I know what happened with your wife. No witnesses except the guy who killed her. He says she ran the stop sign. They had to cut her out with the jaws of life."
I could feel blood veins tightening on the side of my head.
"She died on the way to the hospital and got blamed for her own death," he said.
"Who told you this?"
"Some cops. You got a dirty deal. Something ought to be done."
"You need to disengage, Tony."
"On top of it, I heard the guy tried to pump the insurance company. Shut the door."
I leaned forward. "Listen carefully, Tony. My wife's death is my business. You stay out of it."
"Mabel, shut the door!"
he yelled at his secretary. I raised my finger at him. I was trembling. I heard the door click shut behind me. He spoke before I could.
"Hear me out. The guy ran over a kid in a school zone in Alabama. The kid was crippled for life. You give me the nod, this guy is going to be crawling around on stumps."
"When did he run over a child in a school zone?"
10-15 years back."
"Where in Alabama?"
"What difference does it make? I'm telling you like it is. A guy like that has got it coming."
He was like every gangster I ever knew. They're self-righteous and marginalize their victims before breaking their bones. Not one of them could think his way out of a wet paper bag. Their level of cruelty is equaled only by the level of disingenuousness that governs their lives. "I want you to get this straight, Tony. Go near the man who hit my wife's car, and I'll come looking for you, up close and personal."
"Yeah?"
He lit a cigarette with a paper match cupping the flame. He threw the burnt match into the wastebasket.
"So fuck me!"
I stood up and pulled the sword halfway from its scabbard and slid it inside again. The guard was brass, molded like a metal basket with slits in it. It was incised with the names of 3 battles that took place during Stonewall Jackson's Shenandoah campaign, plus Cemetery Hill at Gettysburg, and extended protectively and cup-like over the back of my hand. The black leather on the grip was both soft and firm, wrapped with gold wire. I replaced the sword on Tony's desk. "I think the Broussard family would be honored and delighted if you gave this to them."
"I'm having a hard time processing this," he said. "I try to be your friend, and you're offended and make threats. If you were somebody else, we'd have a different outcome here."
"So fuck both of us. Tell me something, Tony."
"What? I should get rid of terminal assholeitis?"
"Why do you keep your office in a neighborhood like this?"
"What's wrong with it?"
"It looks like a moonscape. In the next storm, it's going underwater again."
"I like to stay close to the people. On that subject, I'm backing a guy who might end up president of the United States. Want to know who that is?"
"Not really."
"Jimmy Nightingale. People have been talking political correctness in this country for too many years. There's going to be a change, fucking A.
Somehow I believe you, Tony. And that was probably the most depressing thought I'd had in a long time. Chapter 2. I parked my pickup on Decatur and walked across Jackson Square, past Pirates Alley and St. Louis Cathedral, and a marimba band playing in the shade by the bookstore that used to be William Faulkner's apartment. The day was bright and windy, cool even for March, the flower pots on the balconies bursting with color, the kind of day in Louisiana that lifts the heart and tells you perhaps spring is forever, that the long rainy weeks of winter were nothing more than a passing aberration, that even death can be stilled by the season, if you'll only believe. Cleet's apartment and PI office were located in a grand old building on St. Ann Street. The plaster painted a pale yellow, the ironwork on the balcony dripping with bougainvillea and bugle vine, a dry wishing well in the courtyard. Other than the vintage Cadillacs he drove, the only material possession he ever loved was his building, which may have been owned in the 19th century by the same woman who ran the House of the Rising Sun. When I rounded the corner, I saw not only the building, but a moving van at the curb and half of Cleet's furniture and office equipment on the sidewalk. Cleet was on the sidewalk, arguing with a notorious New Orleans character named Whitey Zaroski, known as the dumbest white person in the city. When he was an independent taxi driver, he thought he'd widen his horizons and run for city council. He outfitted a pickup truck with loudspeakers and a huge sign on the roof, and on Saturday night drove into a black neighborhood, blaring to the crowds on the sidewalks, "Vote for Whitey! Whitey is your friend! Don't forget Whitey on Tuesday! Whitey will never let you down!" He was stunned by the cascade of rocks, bricks, bottles, and beer cans that crashed on top of his vehicle. I hadn't seen Cleet in weeks, and I missed him, as I always did when we were separated for very long. Oddly, in the last couple of years, Cleet had imposed a degree of order upon his life. The scars he carried from an abusive home in the old Irish Channel in Vietnam, and the romances that began passionately but always ended badly, no longer seemed to be his burden. He didn't drink before noon, laid off the weed and cigarettes, ate one po' boy sandwich for lunch instead of two, and clanked iron and a baggy pair of Everlasts in his courtyard and sometimes jogged from one end of the quarter to the other. When he'd head down Bourbon, one of the black kids who tap-danced for the tourists would sometimes say, "Here come the pink elephant. Hope he don't crack the cement." None of this stopped me from worrying about Cleet and his swollen liver and his blood pressure and the violence he inflicted upon others as surrogates for himself and for the father who had beaten him unmercifully with a razor strop. I loved Cleet Purcell, and I didn't care who knew it or what others might think of us. We started off our careers walking a beat on Canal and in the Quarter, fresh back from Indochina, the evening sky robin's egg blue, the clouds as pink as cotton candy, and ribbed like piano keys arching over the city. We thought we'd hit the perfecta. The quarter was alive with music and full of beautiful women, and the smell of burgundy and tap beer and bruised mint in a glass of shaved ice and Jack Daniels. Could the world offer any finer gifts? Since the death of my wife Molly, I wanted to see more and more of Cleet, particularly in those moments when I felt as though the defining moments of my life had little application in the present. That somewhere down a deserted street, a bus was throbbing at the curb, the passengers hollow-eyed and mute, unable to assimilate the journey that awaited them. Then the driver popped open the doors with a sucking sound, and I knew with a sinking of the heart that the bus was for me, and I wouldn't be returning to the city or the state I loved. When I have those moments, I say the names of Cleet and my daughter Allifair, over and over. I've done it even in public, indifferent to the stares of others, a napkin held to my mouth or with my chin pointed down at my chest. And that's why I resented Whitey Zarosky and his hired help or anyone else who tried to hurt the noblest man I ever knew. "How's tricks, Whitey?" I said. He always looked surprised, as though someone had just stepped on his foot. He also had a habit of jerking his entire head when something caught his attention, like a meth addict or a chicken pecking in a barnyard or a man with a fused neck. He wore coveralls zipped up to his neck, the sleeves cut off at the armpits, his arms covered with hair. "What it is, Robichaux?" he said. "Mind telling me what the hell you're doing?" "I work for the bank now. They gave me the key to Purcell's building and the paperwork to move his belongings out on the sidewalk. He's got another point of view on that."
"This idiot creeped my house, Drake," Cleet said.
"What happened to your cab business?" I said to Whitey.
"Heard of Katrina?" he said.
"Don't do this, Whitey," I said.
"Off my back, Robichaux. This is a legal action here."
"Whitey, I try to be kind to dumb Polacks, but I'm about to stuff you in the storm sewer," Cleet said.
"How about laying off the ethnic slurs?"
Whitey said. Cleet looked at me and opened his hands. A pale red scar ran diagonally through his left eyebrow where he'd been hit with a pipe when he was a kid.
"This is like beating up on somebody who was born brain dead. Whitey, I apologize for calling you a dumb Polack. That's an insult to dumb Polacks."
Whitey's face contorted as he tried to figure out what Cleet had just said. "Let me see the paperwork," I said.
"It's a reverse mortgage," Cleet said, his face coloring.
I looked at him blankly. "You didn't."
"I was jammed up," he said.
He had a little boy haircut and a dimpled chin and green eyes that never faltered unless he was hiding something from me. "We'll get the furniture off the sidewalk," I said. "We'll work it out."
"Oh, you will?"
Whitey said. He had a New Orleans working-class accent like someone whose voice box had been injected with Novocaine.
"What, I got nothing else to do but walk behind Dick Brain here with a dustpan and a broom?"
"Shoot your mouth off one more time, Whitey, and see what happens," Cleet said.
I placed my arm across Whitey's shoulders. "Take a walk with me."
"What for?"
"Your helpers don't seem to speak English. You don't have an inspection sticker on your windshield. Your license plate isn't current. You're parked in a no-loading zone. You don't have flashers. What should we do about that?"
"Give me a break here, Robichaux."
I took out my wallet, removed all the bills from it, and put them in his hand. "That's about $60. Tell your boys to put everything back in the building and buy them a round. I'll call the bank and get this straightened out."
"We're supposed to live on a beer shop while you get me fired by the bank? I can't wait to tell my boys this."
"Cleet never did anything to you, Whitey, but you're making money off an unrighteous situation that's not Cleet's fault."
"I'll make you a counteroffer. Wipe your ass with your $60. I'll buy the round for the boys, and you and Purcell can haul everything back in the building. Then pour a shitload of Vaseline on it and cram it up your ass. I hope both of you get rich twice and go broke 3 times. I hope both of you inherit a house with 50 rooms in it and drop dead in every one of them."
I had to hand it to him. Whitey would stand up. I had tried to use my power wrongly to help a friend, and in so doing I had probably put an unskilled and poor man at the mercy of an unscrupulous mortgage holder. Cleet and I spent the next 2 hours dragging furniture back into the building or wrestling it up the stairs into the apartment. It was 4 o'clock when I sat down heavily on the couch, my head swimming. Cleet was in the kitchen, pouring 4 inches of scotch into a glass packed with cracked ice. It was not a good moment. My defenses were down, the smoky smell of the scotch like an irresistible thread from an erotic dream you can't let go of at first light.
"You want a Dr. Pepper?" he said, his back to me.
"No, thanks.
I got some cherries and limes."
"I don't want one."
"Suit yourself."
I think I pulled something in my back. I got up and went into the kitchen and opened the refrigerator. I took out a Dr. Pepper and opened it.
"I thought you didn't want one."
"I changed my mind. Why didn't you tell me you needed money?"
"It was 80 grand.
"How much?"
"What I said."
"You got it from a Shylock?"
"I started gambling. I did pretty good at first."
"Here?"
"Everywhere. I had a credit line in Vegas. Google has ruined private investigation. Anyway, I started losing, and I didn't stop until I was broken borrowing on the property.
He took a long drink from the glass, his eyes on mine, the ice and mint and scotch sliding down his throat. I felt a twitch in my face. So the bank owns your place now?
It's not a bank, it's a mortgage company. They screw old people. Maybe they're mobbed up.
Great choice. He set down the glass. The scotch was drained from the ice. He dumped the ice into the sink. I felt myself swallow.
Let's go eat, he said.
There's something you're not telling me. Tony Nineball said you had trouble with Bobby Earl. What's that about?
The problem wasn't exactly with Bobby Earl. I almost feel sorry for the bastard. I heard the blacks were loading up on condoms his first night in Lewisburg.
Tony says you pissed in Earl's car.
Yeah, years ago at the yacht club.
Just recently.
Okay, I'm shooting craps at Harris, and in come Bobby Earl and Jimmy Nightingale with this stripper who used to work on Bourbon. Except it was obvious Earl is carrying the stripper for Nightingale, or at least obvious to me, because Nightingale is a bucket of warm vomit who manipulates the subculture like it's his private worm farm. But right now that's not my business, and I'm simpatico at the table as long as these two assholes leave me alone. I've got $2,600 in chips in front of me and a magic arm, and I'm rolling nothing but 11s and 7s. The broad hanging all over Earl is staring at me with this curious look. Then a light bulb goes off in her head, and she says, "Hey, you're the fat guy who came to my house."
Listening to a story told by Cleet Purcell was like building the pyramids with your bare hands. I twirled my finger trying to make him finish.
"Seconds earlier, I felt like I owned Fort Knox," he said. "Then I see it all draining away like dirty water going down the lavatory. I pick up the dice and rattle them once and fling them down the felt. Snake eyes," she goes. "I'm right, aren't I? You're the guy who came around about that legal problem?"
"Cletus, try to get to the point," I said.
"Legal problem? She got busted for leaving her kid in a hot car while she was stoned and bawling a couple of truck drivers in a motel room. She skipped on her court appearance and left the bondsman on the hook for $10,000. So I passed the dice and slapped Bobby Earl on the back hard enough to rattle his teeth and say, 'Hey, Bob, I hear you picked up another nail. If you're on penicillin, you shouldn't be drinking. Next time out, wear a hazmat suit or get some radioactive condoms for your flopper.'"
He was sitting at the breakfast table now.
He yawned as though just waking up
and put two fingers into his shirt pocket for cigarettes that weren't there. Then he blinked. "What's the rest of it?" I said.
"Nothing. I left. I saw Earl's wheels. I used my Slim Jim to pop his door and took a leak inside."
"No, you've left something out."
"Like what?"
"Why give Bobby Earl a hard time? Like you said, he's pitiful."
"He makes me ashamed I'm from New Orleans. He's a disgrace to the city. He's a disgrace to the planet."
"Does Jimmy Nightingale figure in this?"
"I might have said one or two things I shouldn't have."
"Really?"
"He put his arm on my shoulders like we were old pals. Then he touched my cheek with the back of his wrist. Yuck. I called him a cunt and got escorted in cuffs out the front door. There were only about 300 or 400 people watching."
He cleared his throat softly, his eyes shining. "He's lucky you didn't drop him," I said. "Those security guys, too."
"Think so?"
"I'm proud of you, Cleet."
"Yeah?"
He looked at me guiltily. "What?" I said.
"Nightingale is part owner of the company I took the reverse mortgage from."
Jimmy Nightingale was one of the most unusual men I ever knew. He grew up in Franklin on Bayou Teche and lived in a refurbished antebellum home that resembled a candlelit steamboat couched among the live oaks. Like his family, Jimmy was a patrician and an elitist. But among common people, he was kind and humble and an attentive listener when they spoke of their difficulties and travail and Friday night football games and the items they bought at Walmart. If someone told a vulgar joke or used profanity in his presence, he pretended not to hear, or he walked away, but he never indicated condemnation. In a dressing room or a pickup basketball game, his manners and smile were so disarming that it was easy to think of him as an avatar of noblesse oblige rather than the personification of greed for which the Nightingales were infamous. Please don't misunderstand. My description of Jimmy is not about him or the system he served, but a weakness in me. In trying to be a halfway decent Christian, I put aside my resentment of his oligarchic background and accepted him as he was. Actually, it went further than that. I liked Jimmy a lot, or at least I liked things about him. I admired him, and perhaps sometimes even envied his combination of composure and ardor, as well as his ability to float above the pettiness that characterizes the greater part of our lives. He was handsome in an androgynous way, his hair bronze-colored and neatly clipped and perfectly combed, his face egg-shaped, his cheeks pooled with color, his breath sweet. Both men and women were drawn to him in a physical way, and I think many times his admirers could not explain the attraction. He probably wasn't over 5'9" and 150 pounds, but maybe that was the key to his likability. He was one of us, yet confident in a locker room or at a boxing match, and he didn't feel a need to contend with criticism or personal insult. Jimmy used to say the only argument you ever win is the one you don't have. He was our man of all seasons, a graduate of military school, a screenwriter, a yachtsman, a polo player, and a performer at aerial shows. He could speak on any subject and was the escort of women who were both beautiful and cerebral, although he had never married nor, to my knowledge, ever been engaged. His self-contained manner and repressed intensity made me wonder if he didn't belong in a Greek tragedy. I believed Jimmy had an enormous capacity for either good or evil, and that his spirit was as capricious as a wind vane. F. Scott Fitzgerald once said no one could understand America without understanding the graves of Shiloh. I think the same could have been said of Jimmy Nightingale. He was about to announce his candidacy for the United States Senate. If elected, he would establish a precedent. Yes, Louisiana has produced some statesmen and stateswomen, but they are the exception and not the norm. For many years, our state legislature has been known as a mental asylum run by ExxonMobil. Since Huey Long, demagoguery has been a given. Misogamy and racism and homophobia have become religious virtues, and self-congratulatory ignorance has become a source of pride. I shared none of these thoughts with Cleet. Instead, when I returned to New Iberia in my shotgun house on the bayou a short distance from the shadows, I called Jimmy Nightingale's home in Franklin. A female secretary answered and took a message. "Did you ever have a conversation with a professional ice cube?" "Do you know where Mr. Nightingale is?" I asked. "He didn't say." "Is he in New Orleans?"
"I'm sure he'll return your call very soon, Mr. Robichaux."
"It's Detective Robichaux."
"Thank you for your call, Detective Robichaux. Is your call in reference to an official matter?"
"I really don't know how to define it."
"I'll tell him that. Goodbye."
The line went dead. I lit the gas stove in the kitchen and warmed a bowl of frozen crawfish gumbo. The windows were open, the curtains swelling with wind, the house creaking. The light was failing in the oak and pecan trees in my backyard. On the far side of the bayou, a man of color was sitting on a wooden chair, fishing with a cane pole and bobber among the reeds, the late sun splintering on the water. Since my wife's accident, this had become my worst time of day. My home was cavernous with silence and emptiness. My wife was gone, and so were my pets and most of my relatives. With each day that passed, I felt as though the world I had known was being airbrushed out of a painting. I took the gumbo off the stove and sat down at the breakfast table with a spoon and a chunk of dry French bread and started to eat. I heard a car turn into my gravel drive, the tires clicking, and come to a stop at the porte-cochere.
"Dave?"
someone called. I walked through the hallway into the living room. Jimmy Nightingale stood at the screen, Panama hat in hand, trying to see inside. He was wearing beige slacks and a maroon shirt and a windbreaker with a pair of aviator glasses sticking out of the breast pocket.
"How you doing, copper?"
he said. "Come in," I said, pushing open the door.
"My secretary called me on the cell."
He shook hands,
his eyes sweeping through the house, then brightening when they came back to mine. You look good.
You too, Jimmy. But Jimmy always looked good. He followed me into the kitchen.
I have some gumbo on the stove, I said. Or would you like a cold drink? I just ate at Clementine's. You have such a nice place here. The park is right across the bayou, huh? Tell me the truth. Did my secretary give you the impression she was blowing you off? She's like that, but she's a class act, believe me.
I had forgotten that Jimmy often spoke in paragraphs rather than sentences. She was fine, I said.
Always the gentleman, he said, soft punching me on the arm. I bet you were calling about Cleet Purcell.
Cleet's sorry about the encounter at the casino.
Sprinkling his head with ashes? Using a flagellum on his back, that sort of thing?
Cleet doesn't mean half the things he says.
Finish your supper while I explain something. Come on, sit down.
That he was inviting me to sit down in my own house didn't seem to cross his mind.
He pinched the bridge of his nose and closed and opened his eyes as though fatigued. I flew a biplane today and got a little sunburn. Ever go up in one?
I shook my head.
I wish I could have been in the Lafayette Escadrille, dancing around the skies of France and Belgium, giving the Red Baron a tap or two with the Vickers. War is usually interesting only to people who haven't been to one. You should have been a funeral director, Dave.
Cleet says you own the mortgage on his house, I said.
I own part of a lending company that does. He thinks I'm having him evicted because of a little incident at a craps table?
Are you?
I forgot it 2 minutes after it was over.
People call you a cunt in public with regularity?
Wow, you know how to say it.
Cut him some slack, Jimmy. Then he surprised me.
I'll look into it. If there's something I can do, I will.
I have your word.
I just gave it to you.
I forgot to mention Jimmy was a very good baseball pitcher, both in the American Legion and in college. His best pitch was the changeup when you hold the ball in the back of your palm and leave the batter swinging at empty space.
Thank you, I said. You getting along all right since the accident?
I don't talk about it much.
I understand.
He gazed through the back window. The lawn was deep in shadow, the air tannic and cold, the ground strewn with yellow leaves spotted with black mold. The door hung open on the hutch that once housed our pet coon Tripod, the wood floor clean and dry and empty.
I love your place, he said.
Why?
It's out of another era, a more innocent time.
Why do you pal around with a shitbag like Bobby Earl?
The eyes of God see no evil, he replied.
I've always envied people who know the mind of God.
I'll call you by the end of business tomorrow on that mortgage situation. Can you do me a favor?
I waited.
This novelist who lives up the Teche on Lauraville Road, you know him?
Levon Broussard, I said.
That's the baby. How about an introduction?
You need me for that?
I hear he's a little eccentric and his wife got kicked off a spaceship.
You're the second unlikely person to say something to me today about the Broussard family. The other was Tony Nemo. Is that coincidence?
You know what they say at meetings. Coincidence is your higher power acting with anonymity.
I didn't know you were in the program.
I'm not. I go for the dialogue. It's great material.
I'll ask Levon if he wants to have dinner with us. Jimmy made a snicking sound in his jaw.
That's my man. Make it soon, will you? I really dig the guy's work.
I'm going to get a shotgun house just like this.
See ya.
He tapped me on the shoulder with his hat and went out the door. Jimmy kept it simple.
Chapter 3. After sunset, I drove to the rural two-lane highway where Molly's car had been struck broadside on the driver's door, knocking her unconscious, pinning her inside. I had revisited the site more than a dozen times, either at night or before sunrise when there was little traffic.
There was a stop sign at the access road, then nothing but the long curving bend of the two-lane. By flashlight, I had looked for the pickup skid marks, recreated every possibility about the speed of the pickup, and measured the exact distance from the bend to the stop sign. The speed limit was 45 miles an hour, the speed the pickup driver said he was traveling when Molly's Toyota had suddenly come through the stop sign and made a reckless left turn in front of him. I used a stopwatch to compute the time it would take for the pickup driver to traverse the distance from the bend to the point of impact if he were driving the legal limit. The math led to only two possible conclusions. Either Molly ran the stop sign, abandoning all reason, or she looked to the left, saw nothing coming, then looked to the right, saw the road was clear, and turned left without looking again and got crushed. But Molly never ran stop signs. She would never willingly break a law of any kind. The skid marks, now washed away, were no longer than 18 inches in length, indicating the pickup driver saw her car only seconds before the collision. Everything in me told me that Molly probably failed to double-check the two-lane before she started her turn, and the pickup driver lied and was coming much faster than 45 miles an hour. The causes of the crash were shared ones. Like many victims of violent crimes who never find justice, I became obsessed with speculations I could not prove. I told myself that Molly's fate could have been worse, that the Toyota could have burst into flame while she was conscious and trapped inside, that she could have spent the rest of her life as a vegetable or disfigured beyond recognition or left a quadriplegic. I soon began to gaze into space at the office, in the middle of conversation, on a street corner, my hands bawling, while others stared at me with pity and concern. I had never confronted the driver or even spoken to him because he was part of an official investigation and my contacting him would have been improper. But the day after I talked with Fat Tony, I drove up the Tesh to what were called the quarters outside the little town of Lauraville. The quarters were composed of cabins and shotgun houses that went back to the corporate plantation era of the 19th century. Most of them were painted a yellowish gray and aligned in rows on dirt streets with rain ditches and bare yards where whites and people of color lived in harmony and seemed to enjoy the lives they had. On weekends, the residents barbecued and drank beer on their small galleries, washed their cars in the yard, and flew kites and played softball in the streets with their children. I don't mean to romanticize poverty. The Lauraville quarters were a window into my childhood, a time when few people in the community spoke English and few had traveled farther than two parishes from their place of birth. It wasn't a half-bad world in which to grow up. I found his name, T.J. D'Artez, on a mailbox. I slipped my badge holder and my clip-on holster from my belt and put them under the seat and stepped across the rain ditch into his yard. An old washing machine converted into a barbecue pit was smoking on the gallery, a chicken dripping in the coals. I heard children's voices in back. I walked up the dirt driveway. A dented, washed-out blue pickup was parked in a shed. An unshaved man in work pants and a clean strap undershirt was lobbing a wiffle ball at two little girls armed with plastic baseball bats. His hair was black and greasy and curly on the back of his neck. He turned around smiling. The stub of a filter-tipped cigar was clenched in his teeth. I had never seen him before.
"You looking for somebody?" he asked.
"Are you Mr. D'Artez?"
"Yes, sir."
I stared at him. I don't know for how long. The little girls looked about 6 and 8. They had both gone silent. "I need to talk to you."
"About what?"
I glanced at the girls. "A serious matter."
"Y'all go help your mama,"
he said. His house looked like a boxcar, a poorer version of mine,
set up on cinder blocks.
The girls went up the wooden steps and let the screen slam behind them.
You're from the agency? He said.
What agency?
The Beale Collection one.
No, I'm not. He looked at nothing.
You're him, ain't you?
I don't know who him is.
The husband of the woman in the accident.
Yes, that's who I am.
What you want with me?
You know who Tony Nemo is?
Who?
You may not know him, but he knows you. He says you ran over a child in Alabama.
That's a damn lie.
It didn't happen.
I got a DWI for driving drunk in a school zone there. Well, I ain't hurt nobody. I don't drink no more either.
But you were driving faster than 45 when you hit my wife, weren't you? Through the screen, I could see his wife and children staring at us. These were people for whom bad luck was not an abstraction, but a constant. A knock on the door, a puff of wind, and their lives could be up the spout.
You always got your eye on the speedometer when you're driving at night?
He said.
I think I was driving 45. I can't say for sure. She come out of the dark.
Her lights weren't on. He tried to hold his eyes on mine.
I can't remember.
Your lawyer told you to say that?
Sir?
You heard me. His expression turned into a pout, like a child's. I ain't got nothing else to say.
I hear you tried to pump State Farm.
I missed 8 days of work. Who's gonna pay for that? You?
My wife was a nun in Central America, I said. His mouth moved, but no sound came out. She was a former sister. She devoted her life to helping the poor.
She's a farmer?
How do you get angry at a man who cannot understand or speak his own language? If you were me, what would you do, Mr. D'Artes? What would you feel? There was a big, thickly leafed shade tree by his garage. It was filled with wind, its leaves dark green against an orange sun. He stared at it as though he wanted to hide inside its branches.
This guy you call Tony, he's a Dago gangster you using to scare me?
How do you know he's a gangster?
I know what goes on.
I'm telling you he took an interest in you. I'm not sure why. I told him to butt out. I'm telling you to learn who your friends are.
You're my friend? A man who comes to my house and scares my wife and children?
I stepped closer to him. I couldn't help my feelings. The surge of bile in my stomach. The visceral disgust I felt for his ignorance. My desire to do things with my fists that were ultimately a confession of defeat. He stepped back.
My old lady is calling the cops.
The wind shifted. I could smell his odor, the barbecue smoke on his skin, the grease in his hair. You lied to the state trooper. Until you admit your part in the accident, you'll never have peace.
I'm sorry your wife is dead. She come at me. I didn't do nothing wrong. If you won't accept that, go fuck yourself.
You had your warning, I said.
My family heard that. What's the sheriff gonna say if I call him and tell him that? Answer me that. Yeah, I didn't think so. Fuck you twice.
I walked away, the sugarcane fields and the horizon tilting, my long-sleeved white shirt peppered with sweat, a war taking place in my chest that I knew I would never win. Cleet had two offices, one in New Orleans, one in New Iberia. When he worked out of his New Iberia office, he rented a cottage at the Tesh Motel on East Main down the bayou from my house. When I woke Sunday morning, there were clouds of thick white fog bumping against the tree trunks in the backyard, like cotton on the floor of a gin. I saw a raccoon on top of Tripod's hutch, its coat shiny with dew. I went to the back door and looked through the screen. The coon had climbed into an oak tree and was looking at me from atop a limb. I pushed open the screen. Tripod? Then he was gone. I went outside in my pajamas and slippers and looked up at the branches, but saw no sign of him. I went back inside and dressed and ate breakfast and went to Mass at St. Edward's. When I returned home, Cleet's metallic purple Cadillac was parked in the driveway, the top up, his stocking feet sticking out the back window. He was asleep on the back seat with a pillow over his face. He smelled like a beer truck. I went inside and made coffee and warmed a pan of milk and put 4 cinnamon rolls in the oven, then went into the backyard again and looked for the coon. Tripod had died years ago, but I often dreamed of him in my sleep, as I did my other pets, and I wondered if animals, like people I've known, have ways of contacting us again. A half hour later, Cleek came through the back door, his face wrinkled on one side by the pillow, his eyes bleary. "You just hit town?" I said.
"I'm not sure what I did. I was drinking Jack with a beer back in Morgan City, then my lights went out. You got a beer?"
"Nope."
"I'll drink kerosene if you've got it."
He sat down at the breakfast table. He was wearing his pork pie hat and the long-sleeved tropical shirt he had bought in Miami.
"You got any uppers?"
"Are you out of your mind?"
"You want me to go?"
"No, I fixed you some breakfast. Just don't get sick on the floor."
"Something weird happened yesterday. I was trying to think my way through it. That's why I was drinking depth charges. You know when you're arguing with yourself and wondering if you're letting somebody work your crank? My head feels like a basketball."
"What are we talking about, Cleet?"
"That douchebag called me."
"Which douchebag?"
"The one who tried to evict me, Jimmy Nightingale. He says we can work out my problem on a reverse mortgage. I can refinance and let his company have a quarter-acre lot I own in Biloxi. He'll also introduce me to a stockbroker who'll let me buy some surefire winners on the margin. I asked him why he was doing all this. He said because you talked to him."
"I did."
"You don't think he's trying to shaft me?"
"He wants me to introduce him to Levon Broussard." Cleet looked blank for a moment.
"The writer who's got the wife with outstanding bongos? She jogged by my office a couple of times. I hear she's nuts."
"Has anyone ever used the term arrested development to you?"
"Yeah, the marriage counselor who was screwing my ex while he was counseling us. You think I should take the deal?"
"What'll happen if you don't?"
"The guys I owe in Vegas and Reno are real shitheads, guys I used to work with. Use your imagination."
"I have $30,000 at Vanguard. You can have it."
"That would be like putting a bicycle patch on the rip in the Titanic."
I placed the rolls on a plate and set them in a butter dish and a cup of coffee and milk on the table. "Eat up."
"You're the best, nobleman," he replied.
No, Cleet was, but no one would ever convince him of that. Cleet checked into his cottage at the Tesh Motel, and I called the home of Levon Broussard and his wife Rowena. Levon had been on the New York Times bestseller list for 20 years, and Rowena's raw-edged paintings and photography were loved by many people in need of a cause and a banner. The only reason I'd been given their private number was Levon's admiration for the novels by my daughter, Alifia. The couple lived up the bayou from me in a spacious home built of tear-down South Carolina brick, with floor-to-ceiling windows and ventilated green storm shutters in a wide gallery. The house stayed an almost permanent shadow inside a half-dozen live oaks hung with Spanish moss. Rowena answered the phone. "Hello, Miss Rowena," I said. "It's Dave Robichaud. Is Levon there?" There was a beat, the kind that makes you wonder what kind of expression is on your phone party's face.
"I'll get him,"
she said, and dropped the receiver on a hard surface. "Hello," Levon said. I told him that Jimmy Nightingale wanted to take us to dinner.
"What's he want with us?"
Levon said. "You're a famous writer. He's written some screenplays. Maybe he wants to do business."
"Isn't Nightingale hooked up with the casino industry?"
"Among other things."
"I don't think this is a good idea."
"He's helping Cleet Purcell out of a jam. As a favor, he asked for an introduction."
"So you're being charitable at my expense?"
"He had me." "You're right. Forget I called."
"Is Alifair there?"
"She's living in Bodega Bay." I could hear him breathing against the receiver.
Levon was known for his reluctance to say no to anyone when asked for money or to help with a personal problem. In fact, he seemed to live with conflicting voices in his head.
I don't like these casino people, Dave. They put the Indians' face on their operations, but most of them are out of Jersey.
So is Bruce Springsteen,
I said. How important is this?
Cleet has screwed himself financially 6 ways from breakfast. Jimmy Nightingale can probably get him out of it. We're talking about 1 hour at a dinner table. I heard him blow out his breath.
When?
6:30 tomorrow night at Clementine's. I'll call Jimmy and set it up.
Give Allifair my best. I love her new book.
Before I could reply, he eased the receiver into the cradle. Helen Swallow was in her third term as sheriff, a period when the Iberia Sheriff's Department and the city police had merged. She had started her career as a meter maid with the NOPD and had worked her way up to patrol woman, then returned to New Iberia, her birthplace, and worked as my plainclothes partner in our small homicide and felony assault unit. Helen defied all conventions and categorizations. Years ago, a smartass told her at our department Christmas party that she had the perfect body for a man. She slapped him off the stool, slammed his head into the bar, then picked him up and propped him on the stool and placed a drink in his hand. No hard feelings, she said. She had blonde hair, cut short at the neck, and she never dyed it. She wore slacks and sometimes makeup and sometimes not. Her love affairs included a dalliance with a female informant, which almost destroyed her career, a circus owner, a male masseuse, a feminist professor, and Cleet Purcell. The silence between her sentences was often louder than her words. She didn't carry a throwdown or jam the perps, and as a consequence, she usually learned more from them than others did with coercion. I believed she had several personalities, one of which was a sexual adventurer whose eyes sometimes strayed over me. I didn't care. My feelings about Helen were the same as my feelings about Cleet. I believe their virtues were poured from a crucible whose heat couldn't be measured. Monday morning she called me into her office. Through the window I could see Bayou Teche, the sunlight dancing on the surface, a concrete boat ramp on the far side. Her gaze lifted to mine. She had a ballpoint gripped in her right hand. She clicked it over and over. I got a call from T.J. Tartez's lawyer, she said. I suspected that was coming. He says you said his client. Not true. What were you doing at his house? I told him I thought he was speeding when he hit Molly's car. And I told him he wouldn't have any peace until he owned up. Her thumb pressed and released the button on top of the ballpoint. Click, 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 click. Those were your words? More or less. You know what a good liability lawyer could do with that? I had another reason for being there. Tony Nineball offered to do some damage to him, maybe take him off the board.
You had a conversation with Tony Nemo about killing T.J. D'Artes?
No, I had a conversation with him about a Civil War sword. On the other subject, I told him to stay out of my business. He said D'Artes ran over a child in Alabama.
This isn't coming together for me, Buona.
Tony likes to pretend he's in tight with cops. He bought a sword at a flea market. It belonged to one of Levon Broussard's ancestors. He either wants to make some money off it or he wants to get close to Levon. Tony has been involved with 2 or 3 film productions. He's a self-serving, greedy, fat shit. He's not a complex man. She gave me a look and let the ballpoint drop on the blotter.
Keep clear of D'Artes and Nemo.
I plan to. She stared into my face. Her expression flat. As often was the case, I had no idea what she was thinking or who presently occupied her skin. Her hair looked lighter, sun-bleached perhaps, thicker, and more attractive, as though she had been out on the salt.
"Buy me lunch, Pops, and don't give me any more of your trash," she said.
Chapter 4 Jimmy picked me up in a limo. and we drove up Lauraville Road and turned into the long driveway of the Broussard home. The carriage lamps on the gallery were lit, the floor to see.